Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. VJ Pandian back with us today. He's a horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. And we'll talk with him about, well, pruning oaks, winter prep, and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Join in, give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org with your gardening questions. Love to hear from you. And VJ Pandian, welcome back. It's been a while.
Yes, Larry. Thank you so much for the invite. Appreciate it.
Really great to have you back. Let's talk about oaks for a minute. What can happen to oak trees when they're pruned at the wrong time? Not a good thing.
Not a good thing, yes. Oaks is one of the most common deciduous trees in Wisconsin landscape. But at the same time, you know, it's a bit of a finicky tree. What happens is that, you know, if you prune oak trees during the growing season, it becomes vulnerable to a threat of oak wilt disease. This particular disease is a systemic disease. What it means is that it's spread actually by this fungus, that it spreads to the cut-in areas, and it can spread internally to the into the tree and chokes out the vascular tissues. So your tree will automatically start to collapse down. Now, this particular disease is spread during the growing season by a beetle called a staff beetle. And what it does is that, you know, when you prune an oak tree, right at the cut end, it releases some sap. And this beetle gets attracted to it. And this beetle serves as a vector carrying the fungal diseases. When it lands on the cut end area, it spreads the spore. So once the spore hits those cut area, it easily gets into the system of the tree and causes the collapse of the tree. So that's the reason why oak trees should not be pruned during the growing season. And it's always best to be pruned during the dormant season. So if you look, actually, the DNR recommendation for pruning oak trees actually begins after July. Now, so between like April and July, you should not. But there are a lot of anecdotal observations have studied as shown that it's best to prune the oak during the dormant season, beginning in November till about like end of March. To be very precise, if you have a daytime temperature that is spiking up more than 50 degrees Fahrenheit, it's best not to prune it. Even if it's in the middle of the winter, if the temperature spikes up to more than 50 degrees. So I think right now it's safe to say, because this week is going to be in southern part of Wisconsin high in our 40s. In northern part of Wisconsin, it's going to be in high in 30s, I believe. So probably people can schedule their oak pruning beginning in November, I would say.
Yeah, that I think that will be safe for the trees, and the oak wilt, you know, might be worth talking about what it looks like in terms of you know, the first sign of it and so forth with the leaves and everything.
Yes, you know, the sign of an oak wilt disease happens during the growing season. So we all know in Wisconsin, we have two different oak groups. We have a red oak group and a white oak group. The red oak groups are highly susceptible to oak wilt disease and can collapse the entire tree within a single growing season. And the worst part is that it can spread very quickly, not only by yardborne, but also through the root graft area. So first, initially, you will start to see a sudden collapse of the branch. Kind of looks like as if the branch has been collapsed due to drought stress, where you start to see the leaves have this kind of classic glazing browning leaves, okay, as if it has been torched. And suddenly those branches will start to collapse down. So one after another branch will start to collapse down. So you'll be puzzled during the middle of growing season, what's happening up to my oak tree? And these things could also easily get confused with drought stress, compaction stress, environmental stress injury. So the only best way to confirm it is to send an infected branch, twigs, or even a leaves to, Brian Huddleston, Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab, and get it tested and get it confirmed. So that is the best way to diagnose if you really have an oak wilt or not.
And when you have it, when the tree has it, is anything that you can do to that individual tree?
Well, that's a very good question. Unfortunately, if you have an infected tree, not much can be done. However, you could try to protect the healthy trees, healthy oak trees nearby, because that is one of the uniqueness about this disease is that if you have an infected tree, the infection could spread from the tip of the root to the tip of the crown of the tree. So oftentimes underground, many oak tree roots graft with one another. So that's a very likely chance within a 50 feet radius, okay, if you have an infected tree, it can likely graft to another healthy tree and spread the diseases. So your best bet is to protect your healthy trees, okay? So you need to call a certified arborist. Try to remove the infected tree as soon as possible. So the very first thing an arborist will tend to do is that they will dig a trench around 50 feet radius and sever any root graft areas, okay, that could potentially transmit the disease to a healthy tree. And then they will inject a fungicide, a preventive fungicide, through a trunk injection on a healthy oak trees. However, with an infected oak trees, not much can be done. It could be actually, you know, salvaged. So generally what they tend to do is that they will cut down those trees and they will use those lumbers and either they will burn it, they will debark it, or they will put up a tarp on top of it and hold it up for the winter. So that's the best they can do.
Yeah, it's the best you can do. And there are some sad stories of stands of oaks that were pruned. One tree was pruned and spread it to the other oaks in the stand and just took them all out. There are some really sad stories, so you got to be careful with it. That is for sure. Well, we've got snow on the ground in some parts of the state. So, you know, if you got snow on the ground, what are you going to do in terms of preparing for winter if you haven't done it already with your garden?
So this is the scariest spot, Larry, to be as a gardener. You know, it's unusual that we are having an early snow, but it is Wisconsin. Okay, face the fact. I mean, last few years, we've been very fortunate. We used to have an extended fall season. So in northern part of Wisconsin right now, they have some few inches of snow right now above the ground. So this kind of reminds us that, you know, there is a good possibility we may have a fluctuating temperature. And that's a real killer for many sensitive plants, either a herbaceous perennials or if you have a marginally hardy fruit trees or the deciduous trees. So the best thing to do is to apply some winter mulch. So many people think that winter mulch means that it's going to give you a little bit of warmness or, a blanket cover to many of the plants. But in fact, this winter mulch actually gives you a little bit of buffering effect. It minimizes the fluctuating winter temperatures, okay, around the plant. And that really prevents any heaving out of the soil. So because if your soil gets heaved out, it exposes those sensitive roots to the cold temperature, and this cold temperature kills the root system. To minimize that, you apply this winter mulch. So even if you have a snow cover right now, it's always a good practice to put some like 6 inches of any shredded fall leaves, or even if you have a clean straw, put some about like 6 inches around the base of the plant. And even if it has a snow cover, that's also fine too. If you have actually marginally hardy trees like peaches, or probably even a Japanese maple, then put about like, 6 inches of wood chips or bark chips, okay, to protect the root zone area around the tree. But before you do that, put up a chicken wire around the trunk of the tree, because many times the voles will allow those smooth bark trees. So to prevent that, put up a chicken wire around the trunk of the tree and then pile some wood chip mulch around to it.
Vijay Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I wanted to get to an email from Jenny in La Crosse. She says she needs a refresher on how to overwinter her jelly bean blueberry bush bushes and her raspberry shortcake bushes. She received them in spring. Both are doing great in their containers. However, she's forgotten what to do with them for fall and winter. Does she put the containers in the garage? Should she water them?
That's a very good question. So if you do have plants, you know, a hardy plant sitting in a container, so the very first thing to do is that try to find a protected spot in a landscape. What I meant by protected spot is that it should not be in a fully exposed area, so that it's exposed to full sun, full wind, you know, those kind of things. Or it should not be next to, adjacent to a building or to a driveway. So my ideal spot would be is if you have a tall to medium shrubs, maybe right actually on the east side of that tall to medium-sized shrubs, dig a trench deep enough to bury the container. Because remember, these plants, either your blueberries, your raspberries, they do need some chilling period. So which means the temperature from 32 to 45 degrees, these buds needs to be subjected for some certain number of hours, 500 to 800 hours, so that they can able to bud out and set some fruits for next spring. If they don't receive any chilling period, they're not going to actually, you know, flower out. So certainly they need to be exposed to this cold temperature. So so set your container in a trench, bury the container, and then put some wood chip mulch around to the base of the, around on top of those things, about 6 to 8 inches. And also to make sure that, you know, put some stakes around the plant to and wrap it up with some chicken wire so that the bunnies don't get into it and chew those canes. So that's the best way to overwinter them.
All right. Well, Cindy in Lake Mills has a question for you, VJ. Let's go there. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. My question is, I bought some hydrangeas this year, and they're the blue and pink ones. And I put them in a pot and was hoping to get them in the ground, but we're still working on our house. My question is, should I leave them outside to do the winter, or should I take them in the basement and hopefully get them planted early spring?
So they're in the pots yet. Okay.
Yeah. So the first thing is that I would not leave them in the pots right outside, because the roots can get frozen out and they can kill the plant. So the best thing is, like just I mentioned to you a minute ago, is to dig a trench in a protected spot, bury the container, and then you mulch it heavily. Or the other option is you could take it back into an unheated garage. And this could be a little bit of a laborious work, I would say. So you take it to an unheated garage, set some styrofoam, and set your container on top of it, and pile it heavily with some wood chip mulch. And once a month, check the soil moisture, see if it's actually a little bit moist rather than dry. If it's dry, sprinkle some water to it. That's the best way to overwinter if you want to take it inside into your garage. Basement, you know, as long as, you know, if your basement is cold enough to get about 40 degrees, yes, you can actually store it in your basement. Or if you don't think that you're going to get to 40 degrees, it's best to place it in an unheated garage. Or your best place to bury it actually outside in a protected spot.
All right.
Next spring, you can scoop it out from the container and you can plant it in a desired spot. Yes.
All right. There you go, Cindy. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. VJ Pandy, and horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties, our guest today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest horticulturist, VJ Pandy, and great to have him back. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jane in Elkhorn wondered how to get her burning bush to get redder leaves. And, of course, burning bushes, we consider those invasive, I think, don't we, VJ?
Yes, absolutely. So most of the varieties of burning bush is considered invasive. And but it tend to produce, you know, the seed pods, and that can spread into the wooded areas. So it can cause a huge issue. So, how to turn your burning bush to have a real red fall color? Well, a lot of the time, it depends upon your temperature. By now, you know, when the night temperature drops down to about, like, you know, 40 degrees, 30 to 40 degrees, you know, it'll start to turn its color. By now, it should, actually. But unfortunately, if it is not, one thing is that sometimes if you plant your burning bush too close to the foundation of your house, especially if the foundation of your house is facing towards the south side, the extra heat and the warmness getting from the house or maybe from the driveway, it might have created a micro environment that keeping it a little bit warmer and making the leaves to be a little more greener in the fall time. So that could be one potential reasons why, you know, your plant might be tend to be staying a little bit more green rather than having it into a fall coloration.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. Mary in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Mary. How much snow do you have there, Mary? Oh, did we lose Mary? Oh, we must have lost Mary. Well, Mary, call back. She had a question about, she's in northern Wisconsin and wondered if it was too late to put in her tulip bulbs.
So you could still plant some tulip bulbs. I would still venture out. You know, if you do have some bags of tulip bulbs, you know, so one thing you can do is that, you know, since the ground is not frozen yet, okay, so you can actually, you know, dig it out about 6 inches deep into the ground, and then you could, you know, set your tulip bulb into it. Certainly, you know, I'm kind of guessing that, you know, we might have a fluctuating winter temperature this time again. So, and maybe we could have an extended, you know, spring. So there's a good chance they will all come back and then start to bloom. So give a try.
Give it a shot. Why not? Logan in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about propagation of geranium. What I intend to do is propagate stems in my basement. There are a number of alternatives. Is it a good method to propagate?
Okay. So from my personal experience, I usually tend to propagate my geraniums, usually in about mid to late spring. And, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do it. And, you know, for me, the easiest way is actually I still overwinter my geraniums in containers and then bring them back inside my home and then set it next to a south-facing windows, okay? And it gets a little bit leggy beginning in, like, in February, March. And then it gets too leggy that I feel like, okay, it's time to do a little bit of a, you know, a trimming. So when it gets in springtime, what I tend to do is that I tend to trim some of those, you know, green shoots that are leggy ones, about like 8 to 12 inches, okay? Cut them back, strip some of those leaves off, leave only the terminal end leaves, and then put them in a pail of containers, okay, for about like a 1 hour or so it gets really soaked up into it. And then I will stick it back into another container and buried about like a few inches deep into the container, and it roots out amazingly really well. So that's one way I tend to propagate them. And I tend to time it based on such a way that, you know, if you do have one mature geranium plant in a container, it can sense like so many green shoots. I tend to time it based on when I want to plant it outside and stick those things right outside directly in the ground. So I tend to plant them actually right around like in late spring and plant them directly outside in the ground, those cuttings. In that way, I tend to avoid in trying to pot them back in a small container and repot them back in again in a 6 to 8 inches container and finally send them out. It gets too much work for me these days. So this is one of the simplest way I tend to do, but there are a lot of modified way. But now is not the best time to, you know, split them. Now is not the best time to try to propagate them. These plants are a bit stressed out right now. So give them the necessary winter protection they needed. There are a lot of different ways how to protect them. I tend to keep it in the container itself, set it, you know, in the south facing. They tend to be fine. Some people, they will shake up all the dirt, hang them upside down, and moisten the root. To me, it didn't work out really well for me. And so, but everyone has his own unique techniques, yeah.
All right. There you go, Logan. Thank you for calling. Sherry emailed that her mom and dad have multiple lilac trees in their yard, and this spring they started to look like they were all dying, and then suddenly a month ago they were actually blooming in spots. So wondering what that might be. They're located in southwest Wisconsin, about 80 miles west of Madison. And that's something that we've heard on Garden Talk the last few weeks, BJ, from folks, that suddenly their lilac trees had started to bloom again.
Yes, these things could happen on certain shrubs which have been stressed out. So if the plant has been stressed out for due to some various reasons, from environmental stress issue, probably due to some any other injury, mechanical injury that happens up to the plant, for various factors. And if the plant has been really stressed out and it didn't do very well during the growing season, and all of a sudden in the fall, if you have a really nice, pleasant condition, enough moisture, nice temperature, they tend to all of a sudden will start to trigger some flower buds, and they will start to bloom out. And this happens out in some of the shrubs. It's not unusual, but for us, some average for our normal gardeners might be thinking, wow, it's re-blooming, it's good. And it's nothing to be worried about. It's not going to hurt the blossom for next year. It's going to use some spent energy of that has been typically stored for next year's right now. And it's perfectly fine. So, but one thing, it kind of tells you is that, find out what is the cause, why this plant has been stressed out during the growing season. Why is the planting site location is not a favorable one? Or is it because something else has been bothering or, damage to the cane of those lilac bushes? So investigate onto it, and that would be really helpful to mitigate these things.
All right. Good answer there. You can join in, too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And speaking of that, VJ, we had Lynn in Westby email some photos of a moss or fungus she's found in her asparagus patch. I hope you have that picture. It's a very old patch with new plants added over the years. It gets partial sun through the day, mulched and with newspaper to keep the weeds down. She's wondering what that fungus is, and is it bad, and how does she get rid of it?
I got those pictures in my email box, and I'm looking at it right now. And, it's an interesting one. It is called liverwort, L-I-V-R-W-O-R-T, W-O-R-T, liverwort. It's actually an ancient plant, and it is a prehistoric plant. And, this plant actually is also belongs in the moss category. And it's a very unusual-looking one. And in fact, it has, physiological system is completely different from modern day plants that we have. So what I meant is that it doesn't really truly have a vascular system. So if you're trying to control this liverwort by using a Roundup, good luck with that. Roundup will never touch it, okay? So the thing about this liverwort is that it really likes a moist condition. So this particular site seems to be in a heavy clay, moist area, and that provides a favorable condition for this liverwort to grow. But the good thing is that the liverwort doesn't really have a root system. They have a more like a pseudo root system, just claws onto the top half quarter inch of the soil, maybe at the very maximum. So you can easily rake it. But the problem is, the spores are everywhere. They'll be easily to germinate because of the moist condition. So you need to figure out a way how to alternate this moist condition that you have. What are the ways to, make the soil site condition a little bit dry? And that will be the only best way to get rid of this liverwort. So maybe you may want to think about trimming some of those branches to let some light to get into it so that the light will tend to, help in actually drying out the soil. Or probably you may want to think about actually growing some plants in a raised bed if the soil seems to be very moist in that area. Or maybe you may want to think about, you know, digging some trenches and channels to divert some of those excess moisture hanging in that area to some other different spot. So these are some ways to manipulate that particular site.
Beth emailed to ask how to overwinter a rosemary plant.
The rosemary. Okay. So I have both good luck and bad luck. Okay. I remember one time I was actually overwintering those rosemaries inside a greenhouse. And it ended up actually lasting only for a few months before all those mealybugs and aphids started swarming on those rosemary plants. And finally, I have to give up onto it. Now, at the same time, I had some better luck actually also too in trying to, you know, overwinter them back inside my house as well too. So the trick is that, you know, when you're trying to bring a rosemary plant back inside your house, okay, make sure that there is no sign of any insect presence in those rosemary plants. And then place it actually either, you know, in a little bit closer to an indirect light. And but at the same time, you know, it's also fine if you have it a little bit on direct light inside your house. That's also fine, too. But make sure they don't touch directly the windows. And make sure that, you water it at the minimum level. Overwatering is one of the main factors that also can kill the rosemary plants as well, too. So keep it a little bit in a bare minimum. And, you know, it should do well, you know, by bringing them back. The night temperature is also another key thing. You don't want to actually have a night temperature spiking up to 75 degrees. Keep it a little bit lower to about 60 to 65. Your daytime temperature close to minimum to 70 degrees, and it should do well. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take another call. Fran in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I have a question about the soil that I have planted, usually squash, butternut, spaghetti, so forth. This summer, of course, it got the boar, and we got a moderate amount of produce. However, can I treat that soil now with something to kill what's ever in that soil that's going to emerge in spring when I'm going to plant squash again?
All right, so the squash borer attacked.
Yeah. Well, squash vine borer is very common in Wisconsin in upper Midwest area. So if you do have, you know, zucchinis, you know, butternut squash, pumpkins, you know, it's a magnet for them. It'll find its way. So the first thing is that, you know, if you do have an infected squash plant, you know, do not put them in your compost pile, rake it up completely. You trash it. Put them in a black plastic bag and you trash it. And second of all, you know, try to do some little bit of a crop rotation. I mean, if you do happen to have historically planting the squash and butternut in the same garden area again and again, maybe skip it for 1 year. That will also help a little bit reducing the population. Unfortunately, there is no insecticides available that is something that you can able to apply to the soil because there are a lot of beneficial insects there. And I think, you know, you'll do more damage to it. And at the same time, you know, these squash vine borers, you know, can actually, you know, wander around in different areas in your garden, in your landscape, okay, and can easily overwinter somewhere else too. So the best thing to do actually is to do a little bit crop rotation. Now, even if you do still want to plant it, that's also fine. So the trick is, if you do plant it, keep watching your squash plant, especially when, you know, the chicory flowers, you know, if you see in the roadside, the chicories, when they are starting to bloom, that is the time that the squash vine borer adults will start to lay her eggs actually on the base of the plant. So when you do spot it, that's the time you need to take your preventive measures, okay, to protect your squash plants from them. Either you can use as simple as a floating row cover to cover your plant, or maybe you could actually actually use some organic insecticides, like from neem oil, just to spray to the base of the plant. Or maybe you can use simple as a BT, something like that, to prevent them. So those are some ways to minimize it or prevent those adult squash vine borer, you know, infecting your squash plant.
Fran, thank you so much. Good luck with your squash plants. Appreciate it very much. Claudia in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Claudia. Claudia, are you there? Maybe we've lost her temporarily. We'll try to get her back. Nancy emailed to say her raspberries suffered from spur blight this season and last. She understands from an extension fact sheet that she should remove all the canes in late winter. She knows she will lose her summer crop next year. Her question is whether she has to wait for late winter to cut all the canes. Would any time during the dormant season be okay?
Okay. So, Nancy, I think probably my suggestion is send a first, get it tested first. Send some of the infected canes to our plant disease diagnostic clinic and get it tested and get it confirmed what exactly kills your raspberry bush. There are a lot of many diseases that all look similar, and sometimes there are diseases that also infect your crown and the root very easily. But in fact, if you tend to have a cane blight diseases, probably yes. Probably it's worth removing some of this infected canes, doing a good sanitation cleanup around the base of the plant, and then probably applying some preventive fungicide. Those informations will be detailed when you get your test results back again. But you don't want to assume things, okay? Because normally what happens is that when you assume certain diseases, you know, you might end up, wasting your time and resources with that. I find oftentimes when people plant raspberry bush in a heavy clay soil, they tend to have a root rot and crown rot issue more common. And that really triggers many other things, causing, you know, all kind of stress issues on your plant and even stunted growth appearance and immediate collapse of the plant as well, too. So get your sample tested first. I think that'll be the first right approach to take forward.
All right. Well, now let's try and reach Claudia. Claudia, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is Claudia from Eau Claire. Thank you for taking my call. I have three
anemone plants?
Yeah. What flowers? Yes. Two are Japanese, and the other one, I'm not quite sure about the species, just different the color. And I haven't put it under the ground. You know, right now in Eau Claire, we have snow on the ground. So I was wondering, what should I do with these three plants?
Yeah.
Are they still in a container? Or is it?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So if it's still in a container, what I would suggest is that, wait till about next week or so. If the temperature spikes back to 40 to 50 degrees when the snow starts melting, dig a trench in a protected spot in a landscape and bury the entire container into the ground and mulch it about 6 inches using either clean straw, shredded leaves, or even wood chips. And then scoop it out, you know, from the container next spring and you plant it in a desired spot. So that'll be my recommendation.
Okay, so you can still do, the ground's definitely not frozen. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So something you can do, Claudia.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, and open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. Vijay, how was your season your neck of Wisconsin in terms of plant diseases? Anything unusual this year, or what was going on?
Well, in the southeast part of the region, from the landscape side, we do have a lot of issues. We had actually a spring frost that wiped out some of the star magnolia flowers. We had a terrible year with viburnum, leaf beetle. It's like a chewing monster. And although the bugs are very tiny, both the larvae and the adult, PJ would have given you a detailed story about it. It ripped off most of our arrowwood viburnums completely. And the gymnosporangium rust on the crab apples are terrible this year. So, but on the other hand, okay, we had a wonderful growing season with the fruits and vegetables. We had a bountiful harvest this year. Many vegetables have finally done really amazing well. Usually I tend to hear a lot of complaint about early blight, septoria leaf spots, and all those things. But this year, somehow, we did have an issue, but not quite significant enough. And so the other thing also I just want to point out is that, I was afraid that we may get too many calls on Japanese beetles, but the population seems to be overall fine, or in fact, a little bit lesser, I would say, not into a significant level that causes everyone to be very panicked. But so far, overall, I think we had a very wonderful growing season in terms of fruits and vegetables. Many plants produced quite a bit. I had some great varieties. This time I tested one of the apple aloe tomatoes. They are like a wonderful cherry tomatoes. Then I also had a sweet and neat, container-based cherry tomatoes. It produced a wonderful crop this year as well, too. One of the interesting cucumber I tested is a dragon's egg cucumber. Oh, my, it was such a vigorous plant, early producer. It's amazing. It's a very beautiful-looking cucumber. I really liked it. And it's also produced quite a bit crop this year.
What was the name of that again?
It's called Dragon's Egg. And it's a white cucumber. It's oval in shape, and it's very juicy inside. And the seeds are, it has seeds in there too, juicy and seedy inside, but not to an extent that, it's not that very bitter at all. It's really amazing. It looks aesthetically beautiful as well, too. And it's one of the early producers. Compared to the other varieties, I'm very surprised about it. And it started to bloom early, and, it kept lasting even till about the end of the summer. So that's an amazing thing about the dragon's egg cucumber.
Well, Marilyn in Brookfield has a question. Let's go there. Marilyn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, my call is about several new trees I planted. One is a maple about 10 feet tall that was just planted in May. And the other two are two apple trees that I planted just a year ago they seem to have some sort of a problem with their leaves during the year. I'm wondering what I should do for them, all these new trees over the winter. Do you mulch them?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think many people also are in the kind of same boat. Even this year, I planted about 23 different tree species in our extension office. So the very first thing is that you need to actually wrap your trunk of a tree to protect it from voles and as well as from rabbits. Because maples, apples, crab apples, your magnolias, these are all like a smooth bark trees, and they will really entice many bunnies and voles to gnaw around them. So take a chicken wire, wrap around the trunk of the tree. If you have a lot of vole population, make sure those chicken wires are buried 6 inches into the ground and at least stays about 2 feet above the ground. And, if you do have too much snow cover, maybe in the middle of some winter time, come back, put another layer of chicken wire on top of it, okay, just to prevent the bunnies from damaging and chewing your bark. That is the first thing I tend to do on those things. And second of all, if you do have some extra wood chips, I would spread it actually around the base of the tree. Having an extra layer of wood chips will prevent any of the fluctuating winter temperature and trying to heave the soil out. So put up some 6 to 8 inches of wood chips around to it too. The other thing, if you're living in along with the deers, I would say, and the deers will tend to nip those buds out very easily during the winter time. So make sure to take some precaution how to protect your trees by from the deer. So maybe you want to put up a fence around to it to keep those deer away. These are some, you know, precautions I would tend to do. As far as your apples concern about the leaves, usually apples are susceptible to, apple scab diseases. So just rake those leaves that has been fallen on the ground, you compost it, and maybe next year think about, spraying for apple scab diseases if possible.
All right. There we go, Marilyn. Thank you so much for calling. Vijay Pandian, our guest today. He is the Horticulture Extension Educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Vijay Pandian, Horticulture Extension Educator. Great to have him back. And we will go right to the phones for another question. And Denny in Madison, I believe, is up next. Hi, Denny.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
I have a row of lilac bushes between the neighbor's house, and they've gotten leggy. And I'm wondering if it's possible to make a raised bed situation under them, or does that stress their roots tremendously? Greatly, or can I leave part of it exposed at the level it's at and still do, some raised bed around it?
Are they bushes or are they trees?
They're shrubs. They're lilac.
Yeah, 12 feet tall.
Yeah. So those leggy Chinese lilacs, which is typically planted, as more of a hedgerow, once they become mature, probably yes. It's a bit tricky, I would say, building a raised bed. One thing is that if you tend to build a raised bed, you're going to really stress out those lilac bushes. And sometimes the lilac bushes take advantage of the raised beds, too. It can go either way. What I'm saying it's going to get stressed out is that when you actually pile up a dirt, about like 6 to 8 inches or even 10 inches, 12 inches, okay, you're curtailing any oxygen supplies to the root zone area hidden underneath the ground. So your bushes will be really stressed out because of it. And then you need to think about the shade impact of the lilac bushes on your raised bed plants. The other thing that can also happen is that the lilac bush can also take advantage of it too. When they saw your good soil, good nutritious soil, they'll send out some more new shoots and suckers into your raised beds too. So you can go either way. So my best suggestion is to stay away from your lilac bush. I mean, keep it at least about 10 feet away from your lilac bush plant, and then you can build your raised bed if possible. You don't want to put it directly underneath them, so that doesn't look like a good idea to me.
What about pruning again?
Yes, certainly you can prune your lilac. See, those leggy ones, you could do some renewal pruning. And either you could schedule your renewal pruning after they're done with the blossom. So let's say there is a thumb rule right up there. How much to prune? How much to take out? So that is called like a 1/3 thumb rule. So for example, if you do have a 6 leggy ones, okay, in a year you can take maximum 2 out of it. So you don't want to take more than that. If you do tend to do more than that, either they will retaliate back again with producing more new shoots, or sometimes they will go really stunted. So either way it can go. So you could also, strategize your pruning in that way as well, too. Now, the one thing is also, good to know that if you do have too many leggy ones, it indicates that you haven't did any pruning over the last multiple years, it seems like. And that really could actually, reduce the vigor of your lilac bush. So lilacs tend to produce to blossom in newly vigorous cane, not in too much in the leggy ones. So again, so pruning will really help us out in not only opening up the bush to have some extra light, but also tend to produce some new vigorous green that can produce some, beautiful blossom again in the one. But schedule those pruning right after they're done with the bloom.
Oh, you could prune them. If you prune now, you're pruning away
the bugs. You're
the
taking
buds,
away some but, of potential flower buds for next year, yeah.
Yeah, but you might want to prune them anyway if he wants to get some growth there to kind of screen, if that's a purpose that Denny might have, because they do come, the new shoots come pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you don't care about those blossoms, yeah, you could treat them actually like a regular shrub, and you can prune them in early in the springtime before the new buds comes in. But I would not prune right now. So you can schedule it for, you know, next early in the spring if you don't mind about the blossoms, yes.
Okay. There you go, Denny. Good luck. Thank you. Well, Kristen in Hancock, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I know my region is a 5A, but I found a microclimate on my property that's, I think, a 6. I tried my hand at some saffron crocuses this year, and I have leaves, no blossoms, but it's the first year. The problem is I know I should mulch them for the winter, and I'm currently looking out the window at snow. It's hopefully not going to stick, but when should I start mulching them since they still have leaves?
So, I mean, either you could actually wait till the snow melts, or it doesn't matter. If you want to put some actually mulch on top of the snow, that's also fine too, you know. But it all depends upon what type of mulch they're going to use. So one thing I would tell you, don't use any, you know, full-size leaves. Like, you know, make sure those leaves are all shredded. Because sometimes when you use like a full-size leaves, they will actually compact together and form like a big mat. You don't want them. That'll smother the plant, so you shred them. Or probably if you do have some clean straw, you can also use it too. So it doesn't matter, actually, you know, in fact, you know, if you want to wait till next week with the snow melt, that's fine. Or, you know, if you do have it and you don't have time next week, then you can also do it right now. So that's fine, yes.
Okay. And let's see, Cindy in Antioch, Illinois. Hello.
Hello. I have a quick suggestion for people that have vine squash borer problems. The squash vine will fail. I've wrapped them with tin foil from the soil line up to the first leaf, each stem wrapped in foil tightly so that the eggs cannot be laid onto those stems. And I've also used strips of row cover and wrapped those around the stems. It's a little bit more difficult because the leaves are real tender and the, you know, the hills of the plants are kind of, they're kind of leggy plants. But they both work. The tinfoil keeps them from eggs being laid and the row covers also. So it's just a tip.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy.
Sounds
like a good
suggestion.
Tip.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Thank you so much. I'll try it out next year. So certainly I think that might potentially work. There are a few things, sometimes those vine borer can also, tend to lay their eggs on some of the other shoots, not necessarily in the base. So you still want to keep an eye on to it, you know, on other shoots, you know, that winds up. And if you do start to see some swelling, all you have to do is to take a pair of tweezers and you just slice open it and pluck out those larvae. So you're basically, you're doing a surgery on your plant. And that's always a fun. Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Appreciate it. Claire in Hubertus, your turn. Hi, Claire.
Hi, I love your program. It's really great.
Thank you.
I have a question about a Norfolk pine. It was given to me as a gift for Christmas many years ago, and it was 2 feet high at that time, and now it's 7 feet high. And I'm wondering if I can put that pine outside in the winter months in Wisconsin.
That's a great question. Unfortunately, Norfolk pine is not hardy for Wisconsin. It's one of more like a tropical, subtropical type of plant. And we oftentimes, you know, we use it as a Christmas plant here inside. So it's typically an indoor house plant type. So don't put it outside. You get toasted, the plant gets toasted. Rather, I know it can get really tall and leggy. So you could actually, either you could trim them in mid to late spring, and then you can set it outside in a shaded area. You can able to, live with it inside, but I would not set it outside because it is not a temperate plant.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Ann called to mention that maybe you mentioned chicken wire, VJ, for wrapping, and you meant hardware cloth. The holes on the chicken wire would be too large.
Yeah, so to be very precise, the mesh size should be about somewhere from 1/4 inch to 1/2 inch. 1/4 inch is very preferable. So a hardware cloth would really work really well, yes.
Yeah, there we go. Well, VJ Pandian, our guest today, he is the Horticulture Extension Educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. Talking with him today about a whole variety of things on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along with my guest, VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. So, what gardening questions do you have? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And VJ, we'll take another call. Larry in Marengo, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Good afternoon. I have a question for you about oak wilt.
Okay.
I recently cut down an oak tree that had been injured last winter in the heavy snows. And my intention is to have it milled into lumber. However, the place that I cut it down is known for having a lot of oak wilt, and the place that I want to take it to be milled is not known for having oak wilt. If I move the green logs from one place to the other, will I move the oak wilt along with the logs?
Well, that's a good question. And of course, the spores is going to be inside the bark, and at least for a year or so, until the bark naturally debark itself and the cold temperature kills it. So if it's a freshly cut one, trying to move it from one area to another area, literally you are actually transporting those those poles, which is hidden inside it. But if you are actually trying to move it into an area where they process the lumbers and stuff like that, probably, yes, you might. That's a good potential that, you're going to kill it. But when during the process of transporting, you need to make sure you get an appropriate permit and, check with both with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to see if it's okay to transport such a, infected log. And the other thing, when you're doing the process of transporting, make sure you cover those lumbers, with a tarp. So you just want to minimize any spread of it. Yes.
All right. There you go, Larry. Thank you for calling. Norman in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Norman.
Thank you. I got two questions for PJ because he seems to have the answers to everything.
Okay.
This year, for the first time that I can remember, almost all our varieties of apples had what looked like measles on them, small little 1 to 2 millimeter dark spots. And the Honeycrisp were the worst. But we had it on Empire. We had it on Zestars and other varieties as well. Do you think that's bitter pit?
It's hard to say without seeing a picture or without seeing a fruit. But make sure that sometimes, you know, even like a plum coccolio, they are damaged during, you know, in the late in the growing season. You know, they can also cause a little bit of swelling and a little bit of unusual spots on the fruit skin. And sometimes, yes, bitter pit can also cause those kind of black spots as well, too. So when you slice open up our fruit, you can also start to see, and taste it out and see how the fruit tastes like. So it's hard to say. My best suggestion would be is to take a photograph of your fruit, send it to me, and we'll take a look into it, and we can go from there. Because a lot of things could look very similar. That's one of the things about diagnosing an apple fruit from scab, from plum coccolio, bitter pit, or even if it tends to be something else, some other insect damages, they all look very similar too. So it's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, how does he get in touch with you then with a photo, VJ?
So the easiest thing to do is to go to either one of our Kenosha County, Milwaukee County, or Racine County Extension website. So we'll have our plant health advising email ID published in one of those websites. So just Google up Kenosha County Extension, and you'll find our website, and you can actually find our email ID published in those websites. Yes.
All right. There you go, Norman. Thank you. Did you have another question?
Yes. How about the sudden death of a six-year-old cherry tree? It looked just like that you get in an apple tree where the distal end bends over and it starts to die. But they tell me that for the cherry tree, you cannot get the same sort of thing that you get on apple trees.
Is it a sweet cherry or a tart cherry, Norman?
It was a tart cherry.
Okay. Well,
pruning it back, trying to get ahead of it like you would for the thing on the apple trees, I would prune back to good wood, but it kept going to other branches, and then the branch I pruned would eventually, it would start in again on what was formerly a perfectly normal part.
Mm. Were you sanitizing your trimming blades between cuts?
I tried to spray it with that same stuff that you use for spraying for this COVID-19 thing, which is supposed to kill all the bacteria and viruses in 30 seconds or so.
Okay. How old is it, Norman, your tart cherry?
It was 6 years old. It was one of these ones that was originated in Canada. So it's a little smaller than your Mount Morenci. And it really had a fantastic crop on this year. But like I said, just before it started to get ripe, it started this business with the tips drooping over, just like you get fire blight on apples. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's what it was. And I start pruning it back to beyond where the evidence was, in other words, the good wood. But it didn't seem to help any. It just kept spreading onto other limbs and that same limb even.
Hmm. Yeah.
The whole tree died.
So, you know, it kind of sounds like, either it could be a fire blight or some kind of like, a bacterial diseases. But many bacterial diseases don't cause like a sudden collapse like it, you know. Say, if you do have other cherry trees, tart cherry trees nearby, keep an eye on to it. As soon as you do find a sign of an infection, send a sample to the plant disease diagnostic clinic and get it tested. Tart cherry seems to be a very hardy one for Wisconsin in many places. So unless your root has been suddenly compromised because of the fluctuating winter temperature from last year, but usually you will start to see the sign right away in the following spring. But this is not the case. It seems like, you know, you had a good crop and then it started collapsing down. So it kind of reminds me of a fire blight, like what you said. But if you, what is done is done right now. I think probably, you know, if you do have any other cherry trees nearby, you really need to be vigilant about it. And if you do see those things, send a sample. Like Larry mentioned, I think probably, you know, you need to make sure to disinfect your pruning tool. And whatever the damaged one, the tree or the bush that you have, the cherry ones, those pruned branches and the trees, probably it's best to trash it. So you cut them, bag them, and you trash it, or you bury it deeply in the ground.
All right. Norman, thank you so much. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Ron in Thiensville, your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Hello. Yeah, hello, Larry and BJ. My question is regards saving dahlia bulbs over the winter. Now, when I dig out my dahlias, I have this huge bunch of potatoes there, or bulbs, and I save them, and they come back in the spring, but I plant them, and I get all these shoots coming up and sometimes not many flowers. Now, I bought a dahlia bulb in the spring. It was one little skinny bulb with some sawdust in, and I planted that, and I got a beautiful dahlia. What should you do with these bulbs? What should we do with these bunches of dahlia bulbs?
So the dahlia bulbs, you know, so we call them root tubers. And so in the fall, you know, you shake up all the dirt, and but don't actually tease apart all those individual root tubers, okay? And let them stay as intact as possible. Shake up all the dirt. Let them dry, okay, just for a few days, okay, in a normal room temperature. And then you can start overwintering it. So what you can do, you can take a crate, put some peat into it, and then you set your tuber in it, and then fill it back again with some peat, and then, you know, cool, place it in a cool basement if possible. I still overwintered some of the dahlia bulbs, you know, and what happens is that sometimes, you know, if you don't add enough peat to it or if you don't actually let them dry too long, those two root tubers will desiccate itself and becomes, you know, completely ruined. So I think make sure that you have at least a good amount of, you know, buried peat, okay, about, like, I would say about 3-4 inches in the crate. And then in springtime, probably, you know, in late spring, I would say, you could bring them back outside and you can bury it in the ground. You can bury it about 6-8 inches deep into the ground. And then, you know, you can go from that. And you don't need to water them right away after you bury it. Wait till about the new shoots poke out of the ground and then you water it. Because overwatering usually kills the dahlia tubers, the root tubers right up there. Now, in terms of why it failed to blossom, there could be many reasons. One of the common reasons sometimes I find is that, okay, in some, it could be the basically some of the varieties. Some of, you know, because dahlias, there are a lot of different varieties. Some of them are very vigorous and they produce like a big, like a dinner plate size flowers. Some of them produces like more like a, you know, golf ball shaped flowers, you know. So there are a lot of different varieties. And some of the traditional varieties that produces the big blossoms and stuff, they tend to need to have enough energy stored in the tubers. And if they don't have enough energy that has been stored in the tubers, then they won't be vigorous enough for the next growing season. They don't set enough good flower bud. The second thing also is needed is light. So you need to make sure that they get at least about like a 6 hours of daylight during the growing season so that they can also set the flower too. So these are some crucial things that matters a lot. Again, it all varies from variety to variety. So if you do have one of the traditional varieties, they will tend to have some, they need to have some quite a bit long energy stored in the tubers to set some flower buds for next year.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and VJ. I wanted to relay an observation I made about emerald ash borer. I was doing some tree removal in the Sussex area of Waukesha County, and as you know, emerald ash borers ran through there and just decimated the ash population. But in this area, at this residence, it was surrounded by dead ash trees, but they had two autumn purple ash that were about 40 years old, and they're just fine. They have shown no signs of being affected by emerald ash borer, and I'm just wondering if there has been any research done on autumn purple ash as far as the resistance, and isn't that a grafted tree, and isn't that grafted to its another ash? Or I'm just wondering if there's any information or research on resistance by autumn purple ash to the emerald ash borer, because it would be astounding if that was true.
Yeah, it would be true.
That's a good observation, you know. So far, to my knowledge, I haven't heard about any resistant cultivars, you know, from autumn purple ash, but there are a lot of resistant, you know, the breeding studies going on Manchurian ash, because Manchurian ash belongs to the, you know, in the Chinese Mongolian area, and it normally, you know, has a tolerance to this emerald ash borer. So they're trying to breed that. But at the same time, I was seeing actually some observation at Bonner Botanical Garden, where in the parking lot, they have planted some of the European ash. And next to those European ash are the regular green ash. You can see it actually, the regular green ash trees have been completely toasted by this emerald ash borer, whereas this European ash still has a beautiful crown, stays healthy. And they haven't done any treatments on all those things. So I'm seeing actually a bit of a difference in tolerance or difference in susceptibility, I would say, between some of the different species. But this is the first time I'm hearing about from autumn purple ash that you've been observing some of them. I think that's a very good observation. And I think, you know, maybe you need to talk to some local nursery growers and see they might be interested in observing it. I can also reach out to a state entomologist to see if they happen to hear anything about any breeding program carried out, especially in the, you know, white ash group. See if that's any resistance studies have been done in so far in regard to that. It's a good one. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Well, we'll turn to Janet in Hurley next. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I'm so glad I got on today. I have chrysanthemums that just came into bloom 2 weeks ago, and my New England asters just came into bloom. According to my soil test, I was supposed to add potassium, which I did, 0060. 2 years I've been doing that, and they're still coming in so late.
Can you describe a little bit about your planting site location? Is it planted next to a building, or is it planted next to a sidewalk? Is there a possibility of some radiation effect from some of those building structures that could have created a microenvironment there?
Right next to the garage, I have a bed 25 feet long by 3.5 feet wide. And then the other is on the south side of the house, approximately 3 feet by 12 feet.
Yeah. So the reason why I ask this question is that, so when sunlight gets re-radiated back because of the building structures, you know, both the light and the heat, actually the radiated heat and light, could actually warm up the soil nearby and tend to prolong those temperatures, plants to stay a little bit longer green, okay? And it actually, you know, further delays some of those fall blooming period as well, too, because of the warming effect. And perhaps that could be one potential reason. Second reason sometimes could be also the varieties. Some of the varieties are late bloomers and, you know, some of the chrysanthemum varieties. That could also become maybe one of the potential reasons. But no matter what, you should be very proud of yourself having this bloom right now, because for most of the people, they're all done. For the gardeners, they're all done in some northern part of Wisconsin. There are snow in the ground. It's all bleak. Right in southern part of Wisconsin, it's raining and plants are all shriveled out. So you should be enjoying and thanking. Actually,
right now I have 2 inches of new snow today. last week when it melted, the bees were going like crazy on the New England asters.
Oh, wow, cool.
You should send that photograph to Larry so he can post it on his
I'd
Facebook
like to see
page.
That.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that, Janet. Thank you. Thanks very much for calling.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, I tell you what, we have Sandra emailed. She planted a large number of tulips upside down 2 weeks ago. Should she try to find them and dig them up, or does she still have time to plant more bulbs?
Okay. Well, it all depends where you live. If you're in northern part of Wisconsin, since we have snow on the ground, you know, if it melts, maybe you can try to dig it out and straighten it up. It's been only 2 weeks. Or probably if you want to experiment yourself to see if the bulb's going to naturally turn its way and pop back, that's also fine. You can also do that too. So, but, you know, if you do have time, there's no snow in the ground and the ground is still, you know, soggy and wet, you know, maybe you could, take some time and you can correct the mistake. And you still can plant some other bulbs right now too, you know. There is no harm in planting, you know, late in the season, you know. Take advantage of all those discounted prices. Those bulbs have been sold right now, and go ahead and plant it, you know. So, yes.
Sure. Well, let's see. We had Terry and Robert's email that her apple tree is 3 years old, had a ton of blooms, but only one apple. They have wild trees nearby to help pollinate, but didn't see any bees at the time. Are the bees coming out too late, or what was going on?
So I'm kind of assuming, and you know, she might be having a dwarf apple tree, dwarf or semi-dwarf, because usually dwarf and semi-dwarf tend to bloom actually by right around like a second or third year. Whereas a standard apple tree usually takes about 5 to 7 years. Now, the key thing is that when you're buying an apple tree, it's always best to buy a different cultivar that also blooms around the same time. And there also needs to be pollen compatibility too. So, you know, that could be an issue in this case because you are blindly trusting some of the wild trees. You know, hopefully they tend to carry the, you know, bloom at the same time as like a regular, your newly planted apple tree. So sometimes it could be blooming a little bit later in the season and maybe it could have missed it. So I think my best suggestion is to plant another apple tree about like, you know, 20 feet away from it at the possible. Hopefully that'll help. And as far as pollination goes, you know, bees and wind carries the pollen. So it's very crucial that when the apples are in bloom, make sure do not spray any insecticides either in your lawn area or right on the apple tree or any of the bushes. You know, that will really deter some of those bees, you know, from pollinating the tree. Now, of course, one other factor we don't have absolutely any control is the environment. So last few years, we've been seeing a sudden fluctuating in spring temperature. And so who knows, you know, when you have too much rain during the time of blossom, that could also, you know, deter some of the pollination. Or probably, you know, if you have a sudden drop in temperature, that also could prevent, you know, the pollinators from pollinating. So these are some common factors that affect the pollination. Yeah.
Well, VJ, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us. I hope you'll come back and do it again. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invite. Appreciate it.
VJ Pandian, Horticulture Extension Educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. We'll have him back and talk with us again. November 10th marks the 45th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and we'll talk about the weather conditions that led to that ship going down on Monday. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.